From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. And now more than ever, we need you to join our other generous listeners who make this show possible. For information on making a tax-deductible donation, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Early this past Wednesday morning, word came that after a prolonged illness, Billy Graham had died at the age of 99. Often called America's pastor, Graham was one of the world's most famous evangelists. William Martin, professor of sociology at Rice University, called Graham the most powerful evangelist since Jesus. Graham traveled the world, drawing incredible crowds of people to hear his simple message. Graham had a powerful, charismatic personality, but up close, he was a very humble person. He knew who he was and what he was doing, often making clear to his listeners that he was not a psychologist or a philosopher or even a theologian, just someone who wanted to share with others what the Bible says. Billy Graham walked among royalty as well as people in the third world. He was close to several United States presidents, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, both Bushes and Bill Clinton. In fact, George W. Bush said he would never have been president had it not been for Graham. Graham was an evangelical, but not like the evangelicals of today. He made clear that politics was not his calling. He refused to identify with or get entangled with people like Jerry Falwell. He did not want to spend his time on the political issues of the day, but on the spiritual issues that were touching people's lives. You know, a lot of traveling evangelists became Elmer Gantries or worse. They gave Christianity a bad name. Well, that was not the case with Billy Graham. Growing up in the 1950s and 1960s as I did, any young person who had chosen to enter the ministry was encouraged to become like Billy Graham. Now, one more thing. Graham made some mistakes. He got too close to some politicians. But he was honest. He was honest in saying he made mistakes. Likely, the world will never see another evangelist like Billy Graham. He was one of a kind, filled with integrity and distinguished from all others, including his son. Billy Graham, a great and compassionate life, dead at age 99. May he rest in peace. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We were going to be the ones who were going out into Congress and telling them, this is our fight now because you messed it up so badly that you left it to the kids, and it's our job, and you can't try to take that back from us.
He was able to legally purchase that semi-automatic rifle and come into my school and slaughter 17 of my people. Because of these gun laws, people that I know, people that I love have died, and I will never be able to see them again.
The fact that we are here right now shows that this is nothing like anything we've ever seen before. This is about creating a badge of shame to put on anybody who is accepting money from the NRA.
This is about people who are for making a difference to save us and people who are against it and prefer money. So, Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
It's beyond inspiring. So many Americans grieved, yet another schoolhouse slaughter. Students, high school students, stepped up to say, it's not too soon. It's much too late to change the insane gun laws in this country. So many people who seem to dominate our culture but have been helpless to impact this issue are now standing with the students. Marches are planned. A school walkout is threatened. Perhaps now, at long last, this matter of life and death will be treated as a matter of life and death. On last week's show, I expressed my deep anger at the inaction that always follows the thoughts and prayers reaction to the frequent massacres in our nation. My anger led to a radio commentary. And for others, it leads to bleak Facebook posts and late-night conversations. But it's anger that has galvanized the resolve of these young people, and it's what the brilliant Sharon Brouse described as productive anger that I want to explore. On this week's show, Rabbi Brouse will be back with us to do just that.
Our rights, they don't come from man. They come from God Almighty.
Our rights are given to us by God, and no earthly force can ever take those rights away.
Rights contained in the Bill of Rights do not come from the Constitution. They come from God.
It's frustrating that we live in a time when our nation and our world desperately need people of goodwill and of every religious and non-religious background to work together to build trust and defend against sophisticated attacks on the freedom and dignity of so many in the false name of religion. And yet, so much media attention and increasingly government support recognize only politically motivated culture war waging fundamentalist theocratic conservative Christianity as a valid faith voice. That's why the inclusive, pluralistic, respectful approach to religion and non-religion championed by Interfaith Alliance is so critically important. We'll talk about that work with Alliance President Jack Moline later in this week's show. But first,
well, right now there's legislation making its way through Congress, the Safe Schools Improvement Act. It defines bullying as conduct placing students in reasonable fear of physical harm. Conduct based on race, color, national origin, disability, religion, sex, or sexual orientation. But a conservative group focused on the family is objecting to the bill and other efforts to fight bullying, saying that gay activists are using the bullying issue to push their agenda in the schools.
Focus on the family, audaciously filed for church status in a blatant attempt to hide the sources of its abundant funding. But nothing about the culture wars of the religious right surprises us anymore. I bet you no one is less surprised than Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way and prolific chronicler of the attacks on democracy and even the attacks on sanity that Christianist fundamentalists keep foisting on us. Excellent coverage of this latest turn of events appears on the Right Wing Watch website, and I'm happy to welcome Peter back to State of Belief Radio again. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Always happy to talk with you.
Would you fill in the details of this story, please? How do we even know about this filing?
We know about the filing because nonprofit organizations file tax forms with the IRS called 990 forms, which have some basic information about how much money they have and some other things. And looking at the 990 form for Focus on the Family, I saw that they had changed their filing status, and they had posted a 990 form on their website that said basically, we don't have to file this with the IRS because we're a church. And that was surprising to us.
What did you think when you saw that?
Well, it's kind of astonishing. You know, I've been to Focus on the Family's headquarters. It's a massive campus out there in Colorado Springs. It has its own zip code, even though it's a little smaller than it used to be. Its budget for 2015 was still $89 million. And it functions as a nonprofit. It certainly doesn't function as a church in the way anybody thinks of a church.
Yeah, I've been right where you were on that, and I certainly never had even a hunch that I was walking around in a church building.
We talked to lawyers whose expertise is nonprofit organizations, and they were also taken aback. I mean, they were also surprised. This is not something they see every day.
So what are the real-life ramifications of this?
Well, one is freedom from having to file information with the IRS about income and expenses. One is that they are much less likely to face an audit from the IRS. Churches basically are virtually never audited. And it's also possible that they were worried that Hillary Clinton would get elected and that what, you know, the religious right sees as the forces of repression against religious organizations were going to force more regulation onto nonprofit organizations along the lines of non-discrimination. And there was a cottage industry of, you know, religious right legal groups encouraging religiously affiliated nonprofits to sort of protect themselves from that by developing doctrinal statements. And so we're thinking that that may have played into this as well, sort of a fear of more regulation that they thought they would be free from as a church.
Peter, who would be most excited about this new channel for secret money, and will it be able to directly reach political candidates?
Well, that depends a little bit on how successful the religious right and their allies in the Trump administration are at doing away with the Johnson Amendment, which says that churches and other tax-exempt nonprofits can't engage in direct electoral activity. And we've certainly been very concerned that the efforts to do away with that restriction would really open the door to a giant amount of political money being laundered through churches and turning them into political machines, but then also turning the kind of billionaire political donor class starting to take charitable tax exemptions for their political spending.
Peter, is this a done deal that we just didn't know about, or is it in process?
We believe it is a done deal because the master database of tax-exempt organizations that the IRS has that people can access to see if an organization is classified does indicate that Focus on the Family is listed as a church. You know, we have sought some additional documents from the IRS about the process of that classification, and we may learn more in the future.
What is the historical context for this? And are circumstances so different in this administration, both the chaos and the fundamentalist-friendly atmosphere that makes it a particularly dangerous time for religion to be perverted into just a political tool?
Well, you know, we certainly have seen the Trump administration and the religious right movement using each other. Trump, as a candidate, made a deal with the religious right leadership that if they helped him get the White House, he would give them what they wanted. And they have done that. They've helped put him in the White House, and he's given them a lot of things they've wanted. I think that closeness has bothered a lot of people. Even a number of evangelical Christians think that is threatening the witness of evangelicals in the world by having their leaders being so closely affiliated to a man of, shall we say, questionable integrity as Donald Trump. But I also think that, you know, Trump has this kind of, he seems unconstrained by ethical concerns, and he is now in control of the Justice Department and the other levers of government. And so I think the idea that he would send a signal to organizations that they can push the envelope without a lot of fear of enforcement is a legitimate fear.
Well, if Focus on the Family is designated as a church, aren't there other or scores of others political religious right groups that are likely to try to do the same thing?
Well, we're keeping an eye out for that. You know, we did not do an exhaustive search of the IRS database, but we took a look at some of the other major religious right organizations to see if anyone else had done this, and we did not come across others. One of the others that we did note that was unearthed by another blogger was the Liberty Council, which is one of the major religious right legal organizations that was defending Roy Moore and Kim Davis, had itself classified as a church auxiliary of the Thomas Road Baptist Church. That's also a pretty interesting and questionable classification.
You mentioned the Johnson Amendment. Do you see this as dovetailing with the dismantling of the Johnson Amendment by this administration?
You know, it certainly seems possible. You know, we haven't seen documents and we haven't heard from Focus on what its rationale for doing this was. Mm-hmm. But it certainly seems that if people believe that the Trump administration and its allies in Congress are on the verge of lifting restrictions, political restrictions on churches, you know, it's easy to see that some folks would see that as incentive to try to take advantage mm-hmm. of the newfound freedom to spend political money through church structures.
So what are the next steps? Finding out how this happened? Is it going to be challenged in any way? What are the next steps here?
You know, so far we've really just reported on this uh-huh. and trying to use the Freedom of Information Act to get some more information about the process. And I think that we're sort of sounding the alarm, and we'll keep an eye out to see if this looks like it's something that is going to be exploited by other organizations. And, you know, if that happens, I guess we and others will have to think about what kind of remedies there might be. You know, mm-hmm. it's tough because this whole arena of what counts as a church and what the IRS classifies as a church is pretty fuzzy. For decades, there was a fight over whether Scientology was going to be classified as a religion.
Right.
So in the 1970s, the IRS put together guidance for its staff, basically, mm-hmm. that has 14 things that you can look for something to be a church. But an organization does not have to engage in all of those necessarily to be recognized. So there are fuzzy lines here, as there are in a lot of, you know, church-state fronts.
Yeah.
And fuzzy lines, you know, mean that some people try to push through those.
Mm. Peter Montgomery is Senior Fellow at People for the American Way and a tireless chronicler of the religious right in this country and beyond. Peter, you never fail to frighten us. But despite that, thank you for what you do, and thank you for always being willing to join us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. I'm always happy to be here, and I would like to give a kudos to my colleague, Miranda Blue, who wrote that piece on Focus on the Family.
We're just getting started with this week's show. You'll hear from Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, about how the dominance of the political religious right is galvanizing interreligious cooperation among the rest of us. And later, productive anger. I'll talk with Rabbi Sharon Brouse, founder of ICAR LA. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. On the surface, shocking change has come to our nation. So many things that can only be called unprecedented have been happening in Washington, impacting every single one of us. An astounding part of these changes has been the role that the political religious right has played in them. The degree of the madness may be new, but not the nature of it. Interfaith Alliance was formed as a response to another era of attempts by the conservative Christian right to take over America, lock, stock, and barrel. And in many ways, the organization was born for a time such as this. Now, with that in mind, I'm pleased to welcome Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, welcome.
Thank you, Welton. And boy, that introduction made me feel 20 years younger.
Well, it sometimes makes me feel 20 years older. I was just thinking, we both spent so many years sounding the alarm that reports of the death of the political religious right were greatly exaggerated or it had died. How happy are you that we were right all along?
Look, from an egotistical point of view, Welton, I'm always happy to be right. But this is one of those times when I would have been very pleased to be wrong.
Isn't that the truth? Well, in all seriousness, I think the way this president and this administration has publicly demonized various groups of people, often along religious lines, in a way makes our work a little easier. So talk, if you would, about the organizing and advocating efforts Interfaith Alliance is undertaking in connection with specific target groups.
Well, Welton, what I'd like to say is I think that we are trying to hold our opponents in advocacy to the same standard they set for themselves a long time ago. You know, we have argued with them about the meaning of religious freedom, and we have argued with them about the role of a particular approach to Christianity as dominant in this country. We've argued about all of those things. But especially in the context of the death of Billy Graham this week, it's always been in a context of understanding that there was an integrity to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's no integrity whatsoever. And we're hoping to keep the focus on the constitutional issues and on the consistency of faith groups as they try to advance something that is for the benefit of America rather than just for their own political power.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying our best to get some traction on that.
How do you think we're doing?
On the one hand, I think that there has never been a more important time for our message to be heard, and we're getting the kind of attention that I would be happy for in any circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the president seems to have infected the rest of America with attention deficit disorder,
mm-hmm.
and so keeping people focused on the issues rather than on bad behavior has become as much of a challenge as arguing the issues themselves.
So what is the challenge or challenges that you see right now that are either trying to block us or making our work more difficult?
So I think there is a shrewdness to the way scandal and tweets have distracted us, because there are all sorts of things going on that people are not paying any attention to, that Interfaith Alliance is standing and waving its arms and saying, hey, look over here where the real action is. I'll give you an example. FEMA was recently instructed to begin distributing taxpayer dollars for the repair and restoration of houses of worship that were damaged in floods and fires in the United States over the course of the past few months. That is, to our mind, highly unconstitutional, and also gives nonprofits sort of a double dip. They don't pay taxes because they are a 501c3, and because they're religious organizations, they are excluded from any kind of government interference, except Now, there's money flowing from the federal government, and money from the government always comes with regulations and strings attached. Nobody's paying any attention to that. Some of it is out of compassion. Look, nobody likes to see a sanctuary flooded out or prayer books and hymnals soaked or burned. But part of it is that we're too busy looking at Playboy bunnies and porn stars instead of at the issues. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying to focus on.
Do you feel like more people are getting our message? Is the old, really powerful Niemüller warning getting through, do you think?
I am not sure that warning is getting through, Welton, because I don't think anybody sees themselves as endangered in their area of comfort. If they do feel themselves endangered, I think that people are considering themselves to be unique or extreme among those who are threatened. I don't blame dreamers for not having the energy to defend Muslims. I don't blame Muslims for not having the energy to defend the LGBTQ community. And I defend people who are of differing sexual orientation from not having the energy to speak out about anti-Semitism. There is so much going on and so much emanating, I will tell you, from people who claim to be religious figures in a particular religious community in the United States. But I think as an academic thing, they hear Niemüller's exhortation sympathetically, but as a practical matter, they're too busy trying to save themselves.
Hmm. That's a very good point. Would you just tick off the top of your head two or three issues that the Alliance is going to be focusing on in the next few months?
Absolutely. First of all, we have been focusing on these FEMA allocations. I fear it's a losing battle because it's been enacted by Congress, but it should not go gently into the American consciousness. So that is number one. We fought this battle before with Homeland Security. Not very successfully, I will tell you, but most of those grants are gone, and so most of the government interference because of them is gone as well. Mm-hmm. We will continue to protect the Johnson Amendment, which is still in the crosshairs of the religious right. I know that you know, and our listeners know, focus on the family. And what they've done is just astonishing. Declared themselves a church, in spite of the fact that they are involved in all sorts of political stuff. They want to be able to hide their funding. They don't have to reveal the source of their funding as a religious 501c3, and I think they will probably use it as a challenge to the Johnson Amendment as well. So we're going to be talking about that. Mm-hmm. And the discrimination against the Muslim community through these travel bans that keep emanating from the White House, in spite of the fact that we are long past the 90 days that the president said he needed to review immigration policy, and the Justice Department standing behind religious discrimination and discrimination against LGBTQ individuals, I think those are two areas of overt and unconstitutional discrimination that we're going to focus on. And if I can mention one small thing as well, this week the Oklahoma legislature passed a restriction on who can deliver an invocation at meetings of the delegates. And they are restricting it to the personal pastors of the members of the Oklahoma State Legislature. This is such a blatantly unconstitutional act that we are just waiting for the delicious opportunity to hear from the proponents of this act and the people who voted for it as to how they think they could get away with establishing one set of religions against all the others that are represented in the great state of Oklahoma.
You know, Jack, it's just stunning to me how all of these issues that have to be tackled one by one have a commonality about them. people simply don't understand the meaning of religious freedom.
I think that is a huge problem, but it is a problem that is exacerbated because the opponents of true religious liberty have a propaganda machine that has generated what they need in order to advance their own cause. And by those proponents, I refer, of course, to the religious right. They have abandoned the strong prophetic voice, to mention Billy Graham again, that was part of their original mission. They have even abandoned, I will tell you, the inclusiveness that though Jerry Falwell was hardly a proponent of the values that Interfaith Alliance puts forward, Jerry Falwell believed in a comprehensive America. The narrow focus of the religious right now on excluding outsiders and controlling the family lives of people, even who are not their adherents, and of allowing people to hold weapons and even use weapons, that they're at the antithesis of what they put forward in terms of healthcare choices. That strikes me as being something very different than what we faced back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of this is coming from.
I understand. Okay, Jack, so I'm listening to you today. I've heard you before on State of Belief, but today the issues that you have mentioned and the implications of all of these issues not being handled correctly have gotten to me. So I want to know how I can help deal with the issues that you've mentioned. Can I turn to you for guidance or expertise? And if so, how?
Wow. First of all, thank you, Welton. Since I learned just about everything I know from you, that's quite a compliment. So the first and most important thing I will say that you can do is to keep State of Belief Radio on the air, because I think there is nowhere else where consistently these issues are discussed with the depth and breadth of expertise that you and your guests bring to these conversations. And so listeners to this broadcast who can help us find additional outlets for people to hear these conversations, those folks are very important to us, both in terms of turning to local broadcast outlets and recommending to friends, and by contributing to the maintenance of State of Belief, as I know you request that people do every week. And the other thing, quite honestly, is the encouragement that we can offer through State of Belief to support Interfaith Alliance and what it does. Not just by contributions, although those would be gratefully received, but please invite me to your community and let me talk with a group of people that you'll gather about the important work that we do so that we can help create a presence in communities all over the United States and in turn generate support for our good work.
One other thing before we go, neither our producer, Ray Kirstein, nor I think that we have promoted Interfaith Alliance social media loudly enough. Your most timely and our urgent information gets out by social media these days. So please tell people how to follow you and stay informed.
So there are four ways that people can stay informed. The first is on our website, interfaithalliance.org. There you will find all of our information, all of our program information, all of our statements. The second is through that website, registering for our email updates. All you have to do is sign up and give us your email, and we will not overwhelm you, but we will keep you regularly informed of what we're doing. The third is to like our page on Facebook and to follow what we put up there. Late last week, we talked about the FEMA grants. So this is another way. And if you're if you're really interested in what we're doing, you can follow us on Twitter. And we will be happy to keep you posted with briefer notes that link to our larger message.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all in this country. Jack, as always, it's great to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon.
With all the anger and misogyny on the political and religious right, we sometimes overlook that in many ways we're living in the golden age of female leadership. The powerful hashtag MeToo movement, unprecedented crowds at the women's marches, and the powerful faith voices from religious leaders who are women are transforming the rhetorical landscape. One of those voices is that of Rabbi Sharon Brous of Ikar, L.A., and I'm grateful to be able to welcome Rabbi Brous back to State of Belief Radio. Sharon, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be honest with you. My commentary on last weekend's show confessed my anger, but failed to crystallize that energy in the powerful, constructive way your sermon did. That's why I felt it was so important to expand the conversation. So please tell us what you mean by productive anger.
Well, I think there are different kinds of anger, just like there's different kind of guilt. Anger can make us sick, and anger can make us well. Anger can be a source it can be an incredibly destructive force, and it can also be a constructive or productive force. And it occurs to me in a moment like this that the anger that we're all feeling, that many of us are feeling, is actually a reflection of our vitality. It means that we're not willing to accept that what is what has to be. And that anger can be a very powerful force for social change right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing you, I know there's a scriptural underpinning to this idea. So talk about that, if you would.
Well, you know, what I've been struggling with and what I speak to a little bit in the sermon is that many elements of our tradition over the course of thousands of years work to help moderate our anger because the rabbis have this profound understanding that anger often leads to violence or leads to some kind of dangerous outcome. And so what we have to try to do is move away from anger to again, seek the humanity or seek a more compassionate response. We see it even as early as in the Bible itself, when God lashes out against the people when they create the golden calf and says to Moses, step aside and let me destroy all of them. And Moses is there, the moderating force. And so a lot of the texts of our tradition are encouraging us to move toward moderation when we feel fueled by anger. Mm-hmm. However, there's also a sense that anger can be a driver for good, that anger is a spark, a kind of spiritual recognition or realization that we need to work towards something that has not yet been realized. Mm-hmm. And so this is my sense right now, that there's a kind of urge to, among many, to suppress our anger and to quickly moderate and move away from it. And instead, I think what we have to do is harness it and use it for good, not to create more destruction, God forbid, but instead to create some kind of positive force right now.
You know, we're seeing this in the women's movement. We're seeing it in the students rising up after the latest school shooting. And it's engaging people who might not even have words for what they're feeling. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think we're seeing a real change over the course of the last 18 months, where people are actually taking to the streets because they feel that they cannot contain anymore the frustration and the anger that they have, seeing the direction that our society is moving in right now. And they feel that there's some kind of moral imperative that's demanding that they step forward and bring forth, usher forth a kind of new America, a new way of being in relationship with one another, in which our lawmakers actually feel beholden to us, in which they recognize that their primary responsibility is to work to protect and enhance the lives, our lives and the lives of our children. This has not been the assumption or the reality over the course of many years. And now many people, because of the extremism that we're seeing in the current administration, feel that they're not going to remain silent anymore. And I think driven by anger, but also by a sense of hope and love and faith, people are saying they can't be silent anymore.
For those who haven't thought this through, what's the value of taking the time to identify their righteous anger and then commit to productive expressions of those feelings?
Well, I think we have to check ourselves here. And when we see that our anger is driving us toward cruelty or indecency toward other people, we know we're off track. Mm-hmm. So if our anger is ultimately driving us toward laws and practices, toward building systems that will be more fair, more equal, more just, that will help elevate more people's humanity and dignity, then I think that's righteous anger. Mm-hmm. And when our anger leads towards more acts of cruelty or violence, that's a destructive anger.
You know, one of the motivations for starting State of Belief Radio was not only to share news and conversations, but also to help people know how to talk about things that they care about, but don't know how to talk about. Mm. It right here is a perfect example of that. So if you're talking with someone who said, well, I'm mad as hell about this, what would you tell them to say, how to express themselves about what this is?
So I would say, I'm mad as hell too. And that's a reflection of the fact that we recognize in our gut that something is profoundly wrong with the way that our society is functioning today. It shouldn't be, these shootings should not be. They shouldn't be in America and they shouldn't be anywhere in the world. This young man should not have been able to buy those guns and that ammunition. It should not have happened. And we should be angry about it. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what are we going to do with our anger? Will we allow it to paralyze us? Will we allow it to make us, to fill us with hatred and rage? Or will we use it to productively join forces with other folks who are equally angry about the status quo and actually demand that change is coming? And I'll tell you, I feel optimistic right now after several days of listening to kids and teens stand up and share their anger and their outrage about what's going on and hear their insistence that something has to change. Mm-hmm. I absolutely believe that we're seeing the force for change.
You know, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you is what inspires you most about how these students are organizing as a response to this loss?
You know, they're just not going to play by the rules. I heard a number of students who, the president's going to the school, and they said they're just not going to go. They don't want to be props for his photo shoot. They said, if you really care about us, pass laws that will protect us and save our lives. Otherwise, don't come here and offer your thoughts and prayers to us. I feel that there's a kind of blunt honesty that we're hearing from these kids today. You probably saw the op-ed in the New York Times written by a 15-year-old girl who says, if you care about anything, stand up and fight for what's right in this moment. I think the kids are leading the way. They don't understand why the country is working against them. They don't understand why politicians seem more interested in campaign donations than in human lives. And they don't understand why these politicians claim to be pro-life and yet are only willing to fight for the lives of fetuses and not the lives of actual human children sitting in classrooms trying to learn. And I think that there's something about the honesty, the rawness of their message that is actually touching the nation right now. And I truly believe that this is a turning point moment.
I think a lot of us had forgotten that we are so cynical. It just comes naturally now. And I think we had come to think of young people as being cynical as well. So how do we need to recalibrate our views in light of this example and not use this idea that nothing will ever change as a way to abdicate our responsibility to fight for change?
We need to hand the mic to the teens. That's what we have to do. I went to an anti-gun violence rally on Monday in Pershing Square here in Los Angeles, and the program was very short, but there was a couple thousand people there all milling around. Nobody wanted to leave. And I went over to the organizer, and I said, we can't stop now. People are here, and there's energy, and they want to keep this going. They said, we don't have any more speakers. I said, give the bullhorn to the teens. Let's hear what the kids have to say. And I do think that many of us have grown cynical because we lived through Sandy Hook, and we saw the criminal inaction of Congress. And I believe that many of us have grown to believe that nothing will ever change, but the teens haven't hardened yet like that. So we need to hand the mic over and let them use this moment to express from their perspective what they believe is possible. I shared in my sermon this story that Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen shared about walking on a concrete pavement in New York City and noticing two blades of grass that poke through the pavement. And she realized that that's the life force. What kind of vitality does it take for two living pieces of grass to push through the cement? And that is an expression of a will to live. And I believe that that's what our kids are teaching us and reminding us of today.
Rabbi Sharon Brous's transcendent sermon, Productive Anger, is available online, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Rabbi Brous founded and continues to lead ICAR LA, a transformative come-as-you-are center for Jewish life in Los Angeles. ICAR has now joined with six other big city centers to form the Jewish Emergent Network. Rabbi Brous works with our friends Valerie Kaur and the Reverend Jackie Lewis, speaking nationwide as part of the Revolutionary Love Project. Sharon, I know you're pressed for time. It is so good of you to join us with all of that in mind. I am so particularly grateful that you were able to squeeze us in this vitally important conversation. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Now, before we go, even as the nation grieves yet more bloodshed in an American school, as top law enforcement officials bring meticulously investigated charges against some of democracy's most dedicated enemies, even as far-right forces reject and ridicule tolerance, empathy, and humanity in defense of budgets and national purity, the deep divisions in our nation are built less on convictions and more on characters. As we see politics proposed and principles promoted that have little to do with the soul our nation has boasted of for 250 years, there's a word that I can't keep out of my mind, a word that may help explain why high-level warnings about Russian meddling in our election were ignored, why high-level warnings about election meddling are being ignored, why desperate pleas for common-sense gun safety laws are made fun of, why a long-standing national consensus of what the soul and spirit of America are is crumbling. An ancient word that is remarkably important today, idolatry. It was core to the earth-shaking treatises of Martin Luther 500 years ago, triggering the Protestant Reformation. And it helps explain why religion is so often found at the core of societies where demagogues gather blindly loyal followers. It helps explain why, again and again, we see the rules changing based solely on who the people those rules are being applied to are. Without that explanation, it's headache-inducing to look at the empirical evidence of hypocrisy. In 2013, fully 71% of Republicans told the Public Religion Research Institute that reducing the budget deficit should be the government's top priority. But now, and despite that there were still three more years of supposedly profligate spending by a Democratic president, today only 37% of GOP voters consider the deficit their biggest concern. Now, how on earth can one account for this shift in feeling completely disconnected from empirical data? It can only be that the person doing the spending has changed. Idolatry. This also helps explain why polls have shown widespread support for Russian strongman Vladimir Putin among southern conservatives in this country. It's not a love for the authoritarian policies Putin embodies. It's idolatry. And as in all other such cases, articulate arguments get crafted to retroactively justify this kind of unthinking hero worship. But the justification comes later. First comes the idolatry. And the same thing has happened thanks to the NRA elevating firearms to a sacred and idolatrous status in our nation. Now, make no mistake, this is not a partisan issue. Just one example. I can't tell you how many adamantly, proudly secure liberals I heard pledge fealty to Bernie Sanders at a level of religious fervor. I'm not saying Bernie's not a great guy, but the arguments I'm talking about were not logical, were not empirical. They were nothing short of worshipful, idolatrous. Now, this is the great irony of our age. People who think of themselves as sophisticated and clear-eyed are unrelentingly being manipulated through the best modern technology in the most ancient of terms. Now, you could say that idolatry of our leaders goes back at least to Kennedy or to Lincoln or to Washington. But it doesn't take much in-depth study to find proof that Washington and the Founding Fathers took great care to insulate our government from idolatry and cult of personality type worship. Humility was a core element of Lincoln's personality. JFK never said, "Ask what I can do for your country." This ends badly. This replaces a government of laws, not men, which is what this nation has prided itself on for well over two centuries, with a government of men, not laws. Because no party or tribe is immune from this tendency toward idolatry, every single one of us must step up to the challenge of asking, would this conviction of mine, would this unshakable belief, would this rule apply to another leader? Is my unshakable faith in or loathing of a candidate or a politician or a pastor or a pope based in reality or in blind caveman-level idolatry? If we're being honest, the answer will sometimes be yes. And when it is, we must choose facts over fanaticism, because the stakes could not possibly be higher. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.